Welcome to Alter Everything, a podcast about data and analytics culture. I'm Brian Oblinger, and I'll be your host. We're joined by Pete Goldie for a chat about turning frustration into innovation. Let's get right into it. All right, we're here with Pete Goldie. Pete, welcome to the show.
Hey, Brian. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's awesome to have you on. So if you could do us a favor, maybe spend a few minutes talking about kind of who you are, how you got to where you are today, and some information about, you know, kind of what your background is in would be great.
Sure, I'd love to. So I think like a lot of folks who are into analytics these days, you know, my path to it has been not necessarily straight, and there's been some interesting winding in it, but I think some markers along the way that kind of pointed me towards where I am today. So I didn't study analytics or computer science in school. I actually was a folklore and mythology major because it was there and it seemed pretty interesting. So it was a lot of fun, but it actually translated pretty well into some of the things that I've been doing since then, because folklore and mythology is really about trying to understand why people believe what they believe when they wrote it down. So if you think about sort of ancient religions and things like that, you know, we had things like a sun god or whatnot, and people believe those things because they didn't have a better explanation for it, right? So you look at what are people's motivations for, you know, the things that they hold to be true and try to explain them. And if you translate that, ultimately, it took me a while to realize I was doing this all the time, into kind of business analytics. When people are managing by kind of gut feel and intuition and personal experience, they're often in that sort of folklore and mythology area where, you know, they may be on the right path, but they might not be because they're trying to explain something. They don't necessarily have great information to point them towards a good answer. And when you can illuminate that or expose information to them, often what they believe might change, just like people don't, or most people anyway, don't believe in Thor and Loki anymore as, you know, being powers in the world and in the universe. And, you know, I think, look, a lot of people believe lots of really interesting things, but I think part of the reason there's been so much, you know, difficulty or conversation about religion in general, and, you know, people have been struggling with some of their beliefs and are trying to reconcile these issues between maybe what's, you know, in whatever, you know, religious text they might follow versus what we see in the world or what science is illuminating for us. It kind of comes down to this, right? And so how you reconcile those things is often, on the business side, like the biggest challenge that's there, because when you have executives or stakeholders that have a preconceived notion of something from their experience or whatever it might be, but your information ultimately shows something different, that can be a real struggle to communicate. And, you know, I think that's where great analytics and communication skills come in. And that's kind of where my career is really, you know, evolved over time. I started off with a small data company up in Westchester. I think I took a typing test. That's how I got a position there. I had no database experience or anything else like that. And I ended up involved with this big data collection process and built a database in Microsoft Access at the time. This is back in the 90s. And it was my first experience with any of that. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, kind of stuck with that company for a while and then moved off into some other things. But it all kind of, you know, started for me with wanting to understand how to maybe make better decisions or understand what's going on better. And that's where I started.
Wow. That's fascinating stuff. And so it's really interesting how the folklore and mythology has sort of faded into data and analytics. So what are you up to today? What's kind of the current gig that you're rolling with?
So right now I'm working with a great company called Zeal. It's really cool. They're a on-demand services and technology company focused on in-home massage. So what's really neat is you can download the app, and with a couple, you know, sort of swipes inside the app, you can book yourself a massage sort of on your terms. Someone will show up at your house, and you know, the real differentiators that Zeal has in the marketplace for this, and they were kind of the first company in the space, is a lot of the security and vetting that goes around that process. I mean, obviously, you can imagine you're inviting someone into your home, and on the other side of that, as a licensed massage therapist, you're going to go meet somebody you've never met before, in all likelihood. So there's actually quite a bit of technology involved and a lot of sort of analytics, fraud detection, you know, and all the typical, you know, business questions that you have with a company around, you know, churn and attracting new customers and things like that. So they had some really interesting questions to solve, and I'd been consulting with them for a little while and then decided to come on board and lead their analytics and data science efforts.
Wow. Yeah, I'm downloading that app right now. And if anybody has any questions about why I'm getting a massage in my office later this afternoon, it's research for the podcast.
Exactly. So,
Dean or Libby, if you're listening to this, this is a qualified business expense.
Well, and it's funny you mention it that way. The company also does corporate wellness programs and things like that. So, I mean, there's a lot to it, but you know, I didn't want to go into it in too far in here. Before joining the company, I really was focused in the real estate information space. And I think there's, you know, there were a lot of interesting things to do there. And of course, we went through the housing crisis and things like that. So I had started a small company with a couple of guys, which eventually got sold. But there was a lot of innovation available in that space around analytics. And that was really a lot of fun, and that's sort of what I focused on for about 15 years or so between school and where I am now.
I'd love to drill down on that innovation piece, because I, you know, kind of in reading up on you and doing the research that I do before the show, it's clear to me that you yourself are somewhat of an innovator. So maybe tell us a little bit about how you see that and some of the things that you've done that have taken this nation by storm.
Well, I hope they have. You know, I like to think that I had a part in changing the way people actually look for real estate online today. But all of that work was kind of under the covers or behind the scenes. So the company I started working for was a data provider that was back in the day kind of collecting a bunch of real estate information that was really only available on paper, and digitizing it and then making it available to multiple listing services, which are the organizations of realtors that we all work with when you're looking for a home, and eventually also making it available to online real estate websites like Realtor.com or today Trulia and Zillow, et cetera. So the first thing that was kind of innovative there was we had to break down the doors of being able to collect the information and digitize it. So we were collecting this data in Connecticut in all these little towns, and a lot of them either said no, they didn't want to give it to us, or realizing that they really couldn't keep us from getting it, they wanted to charge us $1 a page to make copies, even though we were requesting it in digital format. So there was actually a Freedom of Information case, I think I was like 24, 25 at the time, that I kind of organized for the small company I was working for, and we stuck with it and eventually won the case. And the result of that case is all these companies you know of today can request public records from municipalities, and the municipalities have to provide it back to them in a, you know, reasonably in the format requested and at the cost to reproduce, instead of this dollar a page concept, which was from, you know, Xerox machines and things that people don't even, I mean, I don't even know how many listeners know
ago.
That. Yeah. So, the project, unfortunately, failed that we were doing, but we stuck with because of the delays in collecting the data, but we kept with the case. And as a result of that case, we're then able to launch a bunch of new businesses, I guess, out of it, because we suddenly had access to this data and became kind of the middleman between all these municipalities and the ultimate consumers of this data, which were end users online. And, you know, in between those two points, there was us and then whatever the web property was, like Realtor.com or what have you, that was actually building the user experience. So that process, that was like a innovation in business process, I guess, more than in analytics. But that kind of opened the doors to what we did later. And what we did later was I think, change, again, the way that people perceived looking for real estate online by providing information about things other than the property. So what I mean by that is, if you go back in time quite a bit, the only information you could find about a home that was for sale was typically handed to you on a piece of paper from a real estate agent, and was really just the information about the home, some pictures and bedrooms and bathrooms and things like that. But when real estate went online and you were able to start searching for homes by zip code and price range and things like that, there were a lot of other opportunities opened up that people didn't really see. And I think we were the first folks to see that. And those were to allow people to look for areas first that maybe met their criteria. Like, they were looking for a certain level of school system, or wanted to make sure it met a safety standard, or it was pet friendly or something like that. So we actually pitched Realtor.com, which was the main, really almost the only player in the game nationally for real estate search. And we said, hey, you guys have this great search where you can type in a zip code and see all the homes for sale. But if I'm moving from New York to LA, I don't know any of the zip codes. I don't even know where to look. Like, how would I even know what neighborhoods I want to live in or think about looking for properties in? So we pitched them this idea where we put together a whole bunch of demographics and school and crime and other statistics for them so they could create community pages. And they had some forward-looking product managers over there at the time, and they bid on it. And we put this product together, and they turned it on, and they found that 30% of their traffic actually went through looking for areas first and then looking at homes in the areas. So it was an immediate sort of hit. And, you know, of course, we had taken a risk, and they certainly had also in putting it out there. No one had tried it before, but it was a hit. And then that, of course, led to us being able to grow that business in a lot of directions.
That's incredible. And I think now it's amazing. A lot of these things are just available. It's just an API, right? You can plug Alteryx into an API and hit run, and it'll bring all that information in. That's a long way from making requests on a per page cost, right?
Yeah, the landscape is really completely changed. Back then, we were doing things like collecting information that didn't exist at the zip code level and modeling it ourselves. That was a big part of what we did. We did that with neighborhoods eventually and other things. But, that business evolved in some interesting ways, because we were delivering this data in bulk to people, and they were building their websites off of it. And eventually, almost any website you could think of was pulling that content from us. The Realogy brands, Trulia and Redfin were customers for a while, all the big brokers. But what we found was that there were a lot of limitations. And when it comes to innovating things, I feel that innovation usually comes from a couple places, like pretty different places. But one of those is, someone literally just subconsciously connects the dots between things and has this great idea that no one thought of. I think those opportunities happen infrequently, but when they do, you get things that nobody's even ever thought of before. But I think what's more likely to happen is that innovation comes from frustration. So, whether it's you being frustrated with some sort of process, or a client of yours, or customers, if you have enough kind of information surrounding the problem, then you can often look at these frustrations and come up with some interesting solutions. So, in a way, that searching by communities was an example of that. It was frustrating to try to figure out where around LA or Seattle or which suburbs or which neighborhoods you might want to live in. That led ultimately to some other frustrations at the time that led to some new products. There was a website out at the time, and I think it still exists, though it's certainly changed and is much better now, Bert Sperling's Best Places to Live. And I remember going there. I lived in New York, and I was thinking about moving, and I was like, well, let's see if it can recommend some cities for me, right? And I plugged in some information, and it turned out that no matter what else I put in, if I entered in that I wanted good weather, like warm, sunny weather, Tucson was always number one on the list. Like, it didn't...
Imagine that.
Yeah. It didn't matter if I wanted, the other things, schools or, crime culture, whatever. It didn't matter. So, as a data guy, I was thinking, there's a better way to do this, right? And and there definitely is, right? And that ultimately led to developing a new product that we went out and pitched again to all these real estate brokerages and websites we called Lifestyle Search, which again is now today not a new concept, but at the time back in about 2008 it was, where you would ask the customer, hey, what's important to you or what are your preferences and how important is that preference? So, you know, you kind of ended up with a multivariate search where you were weighting the inputs and then providing a best match result instead of this kind of hard filter or gated process, which is like that old website that I had tried. So we built this and it leveraged everything the company did, right? So we had all this geographic data and a geographic model. We did all the spatial analysis to say, hey, these neighborhoods are in these cities and they all roll up in this way. And, you know, crime statistics are available at this geographic level, but we need to model them down to block groups, for example. So it was really a big analytics project. And then on top of that, to build the weight sort mechanism to provide best results was a fun challenge also. And it ended up in a product that was typically implemented where, you know, you put up 10 or 12 different topics on the webpage and let customers sort of drag a slider from most to least important. So you put up something like, do you want to have good schools? How important is that to you? And you'd think it'd be important to everybody, but if you don't have any kids, often good schools go hand in hand with higher taxes. So, you know, everything sort of becomes relative. And we did some learning there, which is what I think good analytics is all about, which is initially we just put the product out and we found that everybody who had kids always put great schools, low crime, and low home prices, right? So they weren't actually differentiating among the things that they wanted, what was most important. And we found that we had to sort of limit the number of points they were able to distribute from how important is this, and force them to differentiate, force them to prioritize. And if you can get your users to prioritize their input for you, then it becomes much easier to provide good results. You could always provide results even if they're not prioritizing, but those results aren't going to resonate in the same way. Even in cities that have relatively poor school systems, there are always some schools that are better than others, right? So there are always some areas that have lower crime or higher crime than others, even if it's a safe city. So by having them provide these preferences, you can factor that into an algorithm and provide better results, and then of course test that. So that was a, you know, another project that was kind of born out of frustration. And I think in the real estate space, that's kind of been the history of what we did with this lifestyle search engine was one. We put out the first search API for property search, which allowed our customers to focus on selling homes instead of building all kinds of interesting search, which could include these lifestyle characteristics, but also things like drive time, commute time, you know, whether it was in a certain neighborhood, and then factoring in all the different demographics and community data that we had. You know, to build that yourself, you'd have to gather all that information yourself, organize it all, then kind of become expert in how to build the search. And, you know, a real estate brokerage, that's not their business. So they were very frustrated. They wanted all the data, but couldn't figure out how to leverage it. So we heard the frustration and then built a solution for them. You know, from a business to business perspective.
Yeah. I love what you're saying about the frustration piece, because I often think that the difference between someone who's a complainer or an innovator is simply how they channel their frustrations, right?
Yep.
Like some people will just simply kind of take it, so to speak, and just, you know, hey, that's just the way the world is. I'll, you know, complain about it every once in a while, grumble, whatever. Some people get, you know, frankly pissed off enough to go change the world or, you know, try to come up with a solution. So I think you're right on there. I think that makes a lot of sense. When it comes to sort of these listicles of, you know, the best places to live or how you use the data, I think one thing that's really interesting there as well is sort of the full scope that you're describing, this project or projects, and you're using almost every facet of these analytical products, right? you have spatial, you have, you know, mapping data, you have all kinds of things, the full scope there. Maybe talk about that a little bit. What's it like when you're, you know, trying to solve one of these problems, but you're ingesting and using such crazily different, you know, disparate data sets?
You know, there are definitely some challenges there. I find them to be fun challenges, but I guess, you know, that's maybe what makes me good at solving these types of problems. So the best places to live in these lists are, it's kind of an interesting side avenue to what I've been doing over the years. Money Magazine was actually the company that we started. I started with two other gentlemen, and eventually that company grew to about 50 people. The very first client was Money Magazine. They had been a customer of a previous company I'd worked at, and they, after that company went out of business, oddly enough, and not in any way related to 9/11, but in New York, they went out of business on 9/11. Money Magazine called up a month or two later and said, "Hey, we're ready to run our story this year." And, you know, we said, "But okay, but the company doesn't exist." And they said, "Okay, but we're ready to run the story this year." So we put our heads together and said, "Hey, how can we do this?" And they ended up becoming our first customer. And over time, we also worked kind of the same sort of stories for other publications, U.S. News, Essence, Forbes, Fortune, a whole bunch of them, Family Circle. And of course, if you're doing the same type of product for a number of customers, you start to run into questions about how do we differentiate the product. And we actually, I think, had a pretty straightforward but good process for that, which was we tried to understand our client, tried to understand the problem a little bit better. If you think about one of these lists, it's really what are the best places to live for the readership of that publication. That's what the publication's looking for. They're not looking for some totally objective or impartial result. And it's hard to even come up with that because the best place to live for one person is not the best place for another. So you have to start somewhere. And then once you know where you're starting, kind of build a process around that that in that context is impartial and objective. So what we would do is we would ask them for their customer marketing profile. And then we would look at that and we would try to understand, you know, here's marketing speak for these people. How does that translate into real data that's available to us out in the world? And that information becomes different depending on what that marketing profile was. In the case of Money Magazine, and I still work with them, so you should all definitely go out and get their Best Places to Live feature that comes out in the fall at some point. We just finished up the data work for it. We put about 200 different data sources into that, and it's all sorts of things from, you know, home prices and, you know, current market statistics to crime to availability of conveniences nearby to commute times, you know, you name it. And it was a pretty big challenge bringing these things in. It's become a little easier over the years as data sources have become better organized, but in reality, what you have is a problem where you have data that comes into you at all different levels, state, county, point data, meaning, you know, like these businesses are really addresses, schools are addresses, school district boundaries don't match up with city boundaries all the time, certainly not with zip code boundaries. Lots of data is only available for zip codes. Weather is related to weather reporting stations. So it's really a spatial matching problem. And when we first started using it, this was before Alteryx came out with a product. We were using Oracle Spatial and/or Pitney Bowes Map Info product to essentially do a whole bunch of spatial analytics on the data to be able to aggregate to boundaries and do proximity searching, you know, radius and buffer counts, all these things to essentially pull this data together so that I could tell you, you know, what's the convenience score or an index for this small town in the middle of Iowa? And eventually we redid that process, or I redid that process entirely using Alteryx tools because it's really well suited to that with all the spatial tool set involved. But the problems all remain the same. And organizing that data and pulling it together and creating something intelligent out of it is an interesting challenge. So I'm working with, you know, editors and writers at the publications, and I could output to them, you know, a spreadsheet full of data, but they don't necessarily understand the differences in the types of data points, like their scale. What would be the differences in scale, and how should that impact what they're doing? Because they're taking what I'm giving them and they're trying to create an algorithm that for each place combines all this data and scores it and says, hey, this is going to be in my top 100 or top 10 list and this place isn't. And then, of course, they have some editorial process on top of that. They go out and they interview people and do other things because you can't capture everything in the data, of course. So in addition to combining the data together, then there's a variety of work and modeling work around trying to create scores that they can then combine in a way that's meaningful and don't overly value one data point over another. So a simple example there is if you're dealing with home prices, they're typically in hundreds of thousands. If you're dealing with crime index score, they're typically in the hundreds or the double digits. And if you simply added them up and averaged them or something like that, you wouldn't really be doing justice to either of the data points involved. So that's a process. I've been doing it for about 20 years with them. Their team's changed over time, but the focus of the story has really remained the same with Money Magazine in particular, and has really been a great success for them.
That's really cool. I think, you know, we're a little, I don't know, like I feel like these days there's so many, you know, I'm using air quotes here, lists or listicles out there on the web about things. And I think a lot of them feel like they're just kind of thrown together or someone just made some editorial decisions about what the list should be rather than fact-based decisions. And it's really cool to hear in this particular case, all of the great lengths and, you know, processes and things that you're doing to really get to what is a objective by the data cut of what actually would be a great place to live if I was, you know, in Money's prime market, right? For who they market to.
Yeah. It's a fun process, and I've had the benefit, I think, of being able to help influence them to take into consideration new data sets, you know, over time. Obviously the project's gotten a little bit more complex over the years, but recently they focused more on things like diversity. There's a lot of great data out there on diversity, not just racial diversity, but, you know, cultural diversity around things like food, economic diversity, diversity of recreational opportunities and things like that, that can really shed some light on how an area really feels when you're there. So that was one thing we've added, some tax burden information, you know, and other things like that, that really seem to resonate with folks. I think, you know, we try to stay a little bit away from some of the political questions because they don't always align in any way with any of the other data that we're working with for this type of story. But outside of that, you know, it's nice to be able to have an influence on what are the things that they're trying to consider. And kind of funny story is every year, because this is a data-driven story, every year I get some calls and emails, because I guess I've been doing this for so long that my name's out there a little bit, from towns that want to be in the list, right? So, you know, they'll say, hey.
Tucson.
Yeah, Tucson. Well, Tucson. So, you know, sometimes we focus on big cities or small towns, so there's sort of this natural cut about whether a place can be a candidate. But one town in Nebraska, every year city council made a resolution, a 10-year plan. They want to get on the Money Magazine Best Places to Live list. And they're very persistent in calling me up and saying, what do we need to do to make the list? Right. So I, of course, don't divulge any of the secret sauce, so to speak. I just say, you just have to be a better place to live. I mean, that's really, that's really it.
Yeah. Make sure the sun shines more, right?
Yep.
Cool. So one thing I'm thinking about here too, we've been talking about housing and the data and all this for some time. You mentioned before you've been doing this for 20 years plus. What indicators, if any, I'm making an assumption. You can correct me if I'm wrong, that at some point along the way here, you were doing this work, looking at this data, diving very deep into it. Were you able to detect anything around the housing bubble or the housing crisis? And if so, maybe tell us a little bit about that. Like when did that become apparent to you, if it did, and was it ahead of the rest of the market?
A great, great question. And yes, we did see some things in the data. So back in about 2007, 2008, you know, we were processing pretty much all the public records in the country were coming through our office one way or the other. So we were able to look at, and in fact, we had products built around things like home price trends and volume on the market and things of that nature. So we were able to look at those things, and we started to see some, I think, things that seemed a little odd in the data at the time. Now, keeping in mind, our business was not about making predictions or anything else like that. In fact, our customers were pretty much people who were selling properties. So this wasn't necessarily the type of thing that we were thinking about building a product out of, but just being naturally curious, a gentleman I worked with who was actually our director of data operations, Joe Rugolo, and I, and he's moved on to some other great things, started looking at some of our data sets and realized that there were some pretty interesting trends going on that ultimately, as you look back on it, certainly related to the housing bubble. And we ended up creating what we call the Distressed Area Index, which we did at the block group level. And we originally did this because we thought that it would actually be a great informational tool for government. We were at the time as a company trying to see how our data could be useful to people who are making policy or who are trying to figure out what were the areas that needed more funds for something or more affordable housing and things like that. So we were looking at, you know, things like what was the ratio between 30-year fixed mortgages and the adjustable rate mortgages, the 3 and 5 year ones that were so popular back then, and when those things were coming due for their adjustment, and a bunch of other data points, residential turnover rates, fair market rent, and then some sort of maybe negative indicators like employment or job growth or the lack of that, mortgage delinquency rates, which were actually available publicly at the zip code level. You don't get information about the individuals, but you can see things like the number of people who are behind by a certain number of months. So there's a lot of data out there. And of course, the fun part is figuring out how to put it together. So we put together this index, and it just spit out all these numbers, right? And it was hard to make sense of them. So we used mapping software and built some heat maps around block groups. And we did it just for a handful of cities at the time, New York, Las Vegas, and maybe Los Angeles, if I remember correctly. And it sort of would light up the city here. These areas seem like they're at high risk, right? Or relatively more distressed based on these data points than others. And in retrospect, looking back on it several years later, I think that model actually did a pretty good job of predicting the areas that were likely to have foreclosures. So it was a project that we actually presented at the Inman Connect Conference, which is the real estate technology show here. It was in New York in 2008 or 2009. And there was a panel about what do you predict is going to happen to the real estate market in the coming year. And I remember sitting up there with a whole bunch of real financial analysts and industry experts. And for the most part, they were all predicting kind of rosy colors because it was sort of before the burst happened.
Sure.
And then I remember putting up my slides and saying, well, we're seeing some high levels of potential housing distress in these areas and getting a lot of questions about it. It was definitely a fun panel. And I was kind of the outsider in it, being much more of a less of a industry person and much more just of a data and analytics person. I wouldn't say we predicted things perfectly or, you know, I necessarily would have felt comfortable with, banks using our index to evaluate mortgage risk or something like that. But the trends were there. They were definitely there if you were looking for them and knew kind of how to look. And the fun part was really taking data that wasn't so directly related, things like employment or housing starts, things that weren't so directly related to actual mortgage volume and mortgage delinquency, and realizing that they correlated, you know, very directly with some of the issues that were going to pop up.
Sure. Yeah, clearly the economics of that situation were far, far reaching beyond just simply the house, mortgage situation. And it is interesting looking back on that now. I just went back and watched The Big Short again the other day. Love that movie. And it is interesting how most of the people that, you know, were quote unquote right, to your point, you know, not all the predictions were spot on, but directionally, the people that were quote unquote right during that period of time and were often getting, you know, laughed off of stage at these conferences and things were the ones that were saying, hey, we're seeing things in the data. And the other side were people that either had too big of a vested interest to, kind of say the truth or what they saw happening, or they honestly, because they weren't data driven, they were going with their gut and they say, hey, look, the market's great. We're selling houses like crazy. It's all good. I don't know what you're talking about. Right. So I think it, that event among others, has definitely contributed towards what we're seeing now. Here we are 10 years later, with this move towards data-driven decision-making and, hey, let's not ignore the signs that we ignored last time. And hopefully that bodes well for the future.
Right. Yeah. Maybe it points a little bit back to that whole idea of folklore and mythology. You know, one group of people were believing something because they had a vested interest in it, or it's the way it had always been. And then you sort of had new information coming in, and it was hard. It was kind of hard to spot the new information or to realize that maybe it's something you should be looking at. But, for anyone who's out there listening and trying to figure out how to communicate data like this, that might be complex or might be very localized or other things like that, you know, the real key for us and what resonated with people was ultimately putting it up on a map, right? And having the right tools available to be able to do that sort of thing. Because most people can't look at the spreadsheet and see the shape of the data. I think that's something I do. And, you know, it took me a while to realize that other people don't do that so easily. And so if you can put into a visualization that other people can relate to, you know, that can take the message you're trying to get across and actually have it resonate with people instead of, you know, everyone sat there in a meeting with somebody where you're trying to present something and people's eyes get a little glassy. Usually a picture does tell 1,000 words or 1,000 numbers in this case.
Yep. All right. So switching gears just ever so slightly here, you've mentioned a few minutes ago, you were talking about starting a business and growing that from scratch up to 50 plus people. Maybe talk a little bit about that of being a business owner, seeing it grow. You know, what is the communication like when you're have this big idea and you're trying to translate that into a viable operation on which other people's lives are also dependent for their income and things like that?
Sure. Yeah. It's a hard, kind of road to navigate in some ways. You know, when you're starting off, you have a lot of flexibility in many ways, much more so than as you grow, because you don't really have a lot to lose, right? If it's just you, I mean, sure, you have to fend for yourself and have some sort of income, but you don't have people or clients relying on you or, you know, what we call technical debt that you have to support and things like that. So, you know, starting off, it was great. We threw a lot of stuff up against the wall and kind of saw what stuck. And of course, you know, we tried to make informed decisions about what we were putting our efforts into. From my previous experience, you know, I had a lot of domain expertise and some great contacts in sort of the real estate information space, which was good. I think it's hard in many cases as somebody who's maybe on the technical side instead of the relationship side of product development or ideas, right? Coming up with ideas. to be able to validate what you're thinking about if you don't have those relationships in place. And my other partner certainly brought that to the table. I was really the product and technology and data person when we started the company. So that was great. And, you know, I think I have the skill set to be able to communicate between the technology and the business side, which is also often a challenge for folks. Some people are great at it, some people aren't. If you're a great idea person but not great at communicating it, I would definitely recommend making sure you hire for strengths and bring someone on that can be, can really be compatible with you, but also add that dimension to what you're doing. That's actually one of the growth strategies that we really employed was, and I think is really important also when you're dealing with data and analytics, is not everybody's going to be good at all aspects of any role that you're trying to put them in. So recognizing what they're great at and then giving them leeway in that area and actually trying to force as much of their bandwidth into the things that they're good at, instead of saying, well, they're really not good at reporting or doing documentation, so they have to focus on that, and then making them miserable by forcing them to spend a lot of time on something that they're not good at. I think that's a mistake that a lot of folks make. So we always try to do what we call managing to strength, right? So manage to people's strengths. And on the data analytics side, some people are great at, you know, modeling the data, understanding and looking forward how an application might leverage a data set or leverage the structures and, you know, being able to be forward thinking enough to future proof, at least to some extent, what you're doing. Other people don't have that skill, but they might be amazing, absolutely amazing at taking the output of your systems and understanding what's going on in them, right? Actually doing, performing the analytics and then interpreting them. So, you know, that's one area I think as you're growing is to recognize, first of all, what you're good at and what you're not good at, and then make sure that you hire and manage to people's strengths instead of to their weaknesses. The other thing around, I guess, growing and being able to do that in a kind of a measured sort of way is to stay in touch and in contact with your customers, right? So, you know, creating a market is really difficult for a product. You know, to be able to do that from scratch, you usually either have to have a huge PR or marketing budget or somehow have a big lucky break, right? And you see these companies that have become massively funded well ahead of their revenue as a result of that. That wasn't our situation. So what we did have were these relationships with other companies that had market share. And so, you know, originally we tried to put out our own products for consumers and people loved them, but nobody ever was using them because we weren't out in front of people. We weren't promoting them. We didn't have the dollars behind that. So instead of going down that path, you know, our path was really around empowering our customers. And that worked really well for us. You know, certainly at the point in time when we were all very focused on that business, we were the first people in the space. We stayed ahead of the competitors. We innovated a lot of products. Our customers trusted us, so that allowed us to get them to try new products, like that lifestyle search engine where people would find like the neighborhoods in New York that best matched up with whatever they were looking for. That was, you know, brand new. So when Coldwell Banker put that up on their website, they were taking a leap of faith in us that we had built a good product and that it was going to resonate with their customers. But that was a lot easier for us than, say, building the marketplace from scratch, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, anything else you wanted to talk about today? Any other pearls of wisdom we should be sharing with the listeners?
Well, maybe just, you know, another a quick story about ideas coming out of frustration. And, you know, there's a guy I worked with who, Joey Fernandez, is a great success story. Really smart guy, worked with us as a product manager. But he had jaw surgery at some point and he couldn't talk for like 2 months, right? This is again, back in the late 2000s. And he was trying to figure out things like, what music should I listen to? What restaurant should I order food in from? Or what movie should I go to? And this was sort of, you know, really before the heyday of a lot of social networks and things like that now. And he came up with the idea that ultimately evolved into the company Clout, which I don't know if you heard of, and they're gone now also, but they were the first social influence measurement company. And, you know, he came to me and we sat down, and he was kind of scribbling on some paper because he couldn't talk, but he was going over this idea. It's like, how can you find out who, not who likes something, but who could you trust their opinion and then make decisions for yourself about what they like. And that was sort of the whole genesis of this concept of social influence in the marketplace. And it was all born out of frustration, right? And he built a really big company with several hundred people, and then you know, eventually moved on and was very successful from there. But I think the lesson from that is, you know, there was an idea there that he came up with because it was a very personal frustration. And then the challenge, of course, was trying to figure out from a technology and analytics perspective, is there a way to solve it, right? And, you know, he went in and pitched folks like Twitter to open up their API more, to give him access so that he could do these analytics on not just what people were posting, but on their reach, their response rates people were getting, and, you know, all the other things that differentiate what I would call sort of a fire hydrant influencer who's just putting everything out there to somebody who maybe isn't as prolific but has a lot of engagement in what they're doing and ultimately a lot more influence in what other people might be thinking. So, you know, innovation, again, I think from frustration is a great place to start. And you're, you know, if you've been frustrated by 10 or 100 different things, probably in there's a couple of great ideas.
I love that you just told Joe's story. I've heard that story a number of times, and part of the reason why is I actually briefly overlapped with Joe at my last company, Lithium Technologies, because they had acquired Clout at some point. So I'm very familiar with Joe and the story, and he's a great guy. And what he's doing today for our listeners, because I think this is just another, he identified yet another frustration. And I think it's you know, you'd have to ask him, but my assumption is that, you know, the data heavily told him this too. His new company is called Joy Mode. And what they're doing is they've picked up on this trend that people want access to things, but don't necessarily want to make the investment to own them. And so what Joy Mode does, they're based out of LA here, just a little bit north from where I'm sitting right now. And what they do is you get the app or you go to their website and you basically say, you know, I'd love to have a backyard barbecue tonight with a big movie screen and an inflatable flamingo and whatever else, right? But I don't want to go to the store and buy all this stuff, the oversized Jenga game and whatever. And what they'll do is they'll just rent it to you, basically. So you say, hey, I'd like this package and that stuff, and they bring it to your house. You know, you set it up, you have your beautiful event, and then, you know, it gets returned to them. So I think another great example of, you know, sort of reading the tea leaves, looking around the corner a little bit and building a business based on, you know, some frustrations of I want to have these nice things, but I don't necessarily want them forever sitting in my garage collecting dust. So I'm glad you told that story. Joe's a great guy, and we'll put the links in the show notes to his story and his Twitter. He's great on Twitter as well. So
yeah, I didn't realize that you had overlapped with him. I actually spent some time with him out at the Inspire show in Anaheim, a month ago or whatever that was. And so a kind of a interesting thing about his new business, his old business was really a pure analytics business, the Clout, right? His new business has a lot of parallels to what we do over at Zeal in the on-demand in-home massage space, and that it's really a logistics question or a logistics challenge. So if you think about it, he's delivering and then picking up product to thousands of people every day, right? And he has to figure out what to store, how to store it, how to deliver it, all that sort of stuff. So there's some pretty similar problems there, which I found interesting. But the, you know, the original idea for Joy Mode, if I remember my first conversation with him about it, was around what you just said. Someone's throwing a party. Nobody is going to buy and own a bouncy house, right, and use it three times when their kids are little and then throw it away. That's too big an investment. So, you know, I think he was thinking about those things, and it turns out because he's so analytics minded and focused and, you know, has really concentrated his business in part on the data collection side to understand how people are using the products. It turns out that what people really use the service for the most are things like waffle irons and vacuum cleaners, right? And tools and things that, you know, you probably have a whole bunch of sitting in your basement, and they don't seem like the type of thing that would work in this kind of sharing, you know, I don't need to own it mode, but actually really do. How many times a year do you actually make waffles? How many times a year do you need a wet vac, right? Or whatever else it is. So his business has evolved and pivoted from his original idea also, which is I only bring up because, you know, that's super important, is to understand, you know, when to listen to the information that you're gathering and make a change in direction, especially with a small business. If you're a big business, maybe you can split off a new R&D thing or do something else like that. But when you're a small business and you're trying to figure out your path to go down, analytics can really be your friend if you're collecting good information and you learn how to intuit direction from it. And I think Joey's a master at that.
All right, so let's wrap up with our community picks. What has been interesting to you lately that you'd like to point people to?
Well, a couple of things. So one is that I'm kind of an avid reader, and I really think it's important to read not just things in your sort of space, but things outside of it. So, you know, for me, probably as with a lot of kind of data geeks out there, I'd like to read, you know, like fantasy, science fiction sort of stuff. There's a great service for finding new books and finding them at a discounted rate called BookBub. And every day I get an email from them. It's got a list of books in it that the authors or the service that's selling it have discounted for that day. And sometimes they're even free, right? So, and you pick your categories that you might be interested in. In addition to the science fiction side of things, you know, entrepreneurship, small business, applications, things like that are in my list. And, you know, I don't always find something that I want, but it's a pretty good way to build up a library at a low investment. So that's a really cool service, especially if you're selective in the topics that you let them send you stuff about. So, you don't get too much and it stays on point for you. So that one's pretty cool. Another thing, you know, I listen to a bunch of podcasts. I'm one of those commuters on the train who's got the headphones on, and I'm not listening to music mostly. I'm listening to podcasts. One of the ones that I love and is actually a great way to get an introduction to some analytics and data science topics is Data Skeptic Podcast. Kyle and Linda run it, and they do a couple of things. They do interviews kind of along the lines of this one. On data science topics, but they also do a whole bunch of what they call mini episodes. And they're a husband and wife team, and Linda does not have expertise in the analytics and data science space. So typically they'll bring up a topic like clustering or the curse of dimensionality or spatial analytics. And Kyle will sort of introduce it as a problem to somebody who's not experienced in that area. So it's a great intro for people who don't have a lot of background in things. And I've often gone and listened to those mini episodes when I'm thinking about a new model or something I don't have experience with before. It can be pretty helpful. And I also use that in my training. I do a lot of training of folks in the analytics space at the company I work with. And this is a great resource for them. So those are two. And I guess the third one that I'd mention, which is kind of a shout out right back at you, Brian, is, you know, the AlteryX community and the training area have really improved over the years, right? And right now, I think there's a lot of great resources out there. So one of the things I'm working on now at Zeal is distributing kind of analytics know-how and tool sets out into some of the other departments. And so we've got a group of folks from marketing and product and even the sales team who are starting to use some of the tool set. And not only can they self-serve a lot of resources there, but I've actually found from the perspective of holding kind of training and information sharing sessions that having them do some of the weekly challenges that are up there. And there's like 120 of them now. So you're not going to run out anytime soon. Having them do that and then talking through how there are different approaches to solving the same problem and why one might have chosen one approach over another is really useful for learning, right? You often get an introduction to a new tool because there's like several hundred on the tool palette these days. And I don't use them all, right? So sometimes someone uses something I've never used and I get to learn from it too. So I think, you know, that's another great resource that if people aren't using, I definitely recommend it.
Yeah, those are great picks. Thanks for the shout out to Alteryx Academy there. I'm also a podcast listener, so I guess I'll follow your lead here and give a couple that I think might be interesting to our audience. One is Podcast Your Data, and that's our friends over at Interworks. They're actually a partner of Alteryx, but they have a great show where they put it out twice a month and they talk about different analytical, you know, challenges and software and platforms and things like that. So that's a good one. I also get a lot of value out of Freakonomics Radio. I don't know if you've ever listened to that one, but Stephen Dubner, who was actually one of our keynote speakers at Inspire a couple of years back, they sort of gloss over analytics specifically as a topic, but you can tell that a lot of the things that they say and talk about are rooted in that and how they're using, you know, different data sets and data points to look at the sort of economics of, you know, any given topic on any given week. And they're pretty prolific. There's just like show after show after show that gets published. So that's another one where you'll never run out of content. And it's so widely varied what they talk about that I think, you know, you can probably cruise through the list and find something that's immediately important or interesting to you. So those are two good ones. And then also, we'll throw Joy Mode in there because I think it's a fantastic service and Joe's a great guy and it'd be, you know, great for everybody to go check that one out.
Yeah, they're great. And look, there's so much great stuff out there. It's too bad that there's not unlimited time to go in and listen to those things. The Freakonomics Radio is a great one also. And I think that Joey and Joy Mode are getting ready to do some expansion. So hopefully some of your listeners outside of LA will be able to check out the service sometime soon too.
Awesome. All right, Pete. Well, hey, this has been fantastic. You are a crazy, insightful guy, and I'm so just thrilled to have the opportunity to talk to you. So thanks for your time. Thanks for being on. Thanks for sharing with us. Where do people go to get more of you? Are you a Twitter guy? Are you blowing up the Twittersphere? Where do they go to find more Pete?
First, thanks. And it's great to be part of the community here. So you can find me in the Alteryx community, of course. I am on Twitter. I'm definitely not prolific there, though I would absolutely respond to folks, and I should probably be doing more. My consulting company is called Witlytic, and I'll send you the link to it because it's a little hard to spell. So you can find me there also, but you know, my handle almost everywhere is peter.goldie, so not that hard to track down, and I love you know, starting up conversations with folks, especially if you're thinking about some new idea, you're stuck, you're trying to validate something, you know, talking through a challenge is, you know, really the most fun for me. You know, execution is the most important thing to getting your business going, but brainstorming it is sometimes the fun part.
Yes. And as always, we will put all of the links to everything we've talked about and ways to get a hold of Pete in our show notes at community.alteryx.com/podcast. So thanks so much, Pete, for being on again. I just can't thank you enough. This has been great. And we will talk to you again soon.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Brian.